Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way? Welcome back to the Henson Perspective. I'm Ben.
I'm Pete.
And you join us today where we discuss the 45th anniversary of the original New York broadcast of the Ethel Merman episode of The Muppet Show. Originally broadcast on February 21st, 1977, after having been recorded on November 16th through the 18th of 1976. This was production episode 22, so this was two from the end of the whole season. And this was an opportunity, as we'll get into, when Kermit introduces Ms. Merman. He was very excited about the sheer legacy of this actress and performer. I think he's been pleased and proud, and I think through his exuberance, we've assumed how much Jim and the production team were excited about having certain guests. This, I think, was one of the things that helped them feel like we're getting great people, even if Ms. Merman might not have been on the up trajectory of her career. This was still, I think, for them, a really great get.
Mm. Yeah, the reverence they treated her with throughout the whole episode was clear. Mm-hmm. That she was obviously, she was a big name to Broadway, but maybe not, I don't know, in other aspects. But clearly to the Muppets, she was an idol.
Legendary to a huge degree. It will be referred to in the dialogue that we'll talk about later in the show. This is also, with regard to it being the third to last episode of the season, a really strong contender in terms of integration of guest backstage theme and overall production. I think this might be the first episode I've noticed where it seemed like they were paying attention to the reality of the show. More often than not, you have people walking on from backstage afterwards, much like in the Phyllis Diller episode, where you talked about there was a lot of backstage action and little gags going on. Mm-hmm. The continuity of people leaving and coming from on stage, of Kermit cueing acts, of the costume of the guest star being what she wears in the last number, this starts to feel like people paying attention to the reality of the show within the show with meticulous detail. With a couple of exceptions.
Yeah, similar to the Valerie Harper episode. Mm-hmm. Also, the B story eventually coalesces with the A story.
Which was two production episodes earlier than this. Mm-hmm. So it really does feel like they're moving steadily in that direction. And by the beginning of next season, potentially, it will be what they're doing all the time.
I hope so, because these later episodes are so much more enjoyable as a whole than the earlier episodes. The earlier episodes have great segments in them, but they are just that. It is a variety show back then.
Right.
And this is more of a cohesive variety show.
It feels, we've talked about the difference with this language before, the idea that it goes from being a true variety show into a sitcom with variety elements. Mm-hmm. And the way in which in a sitcom you often have A, B, and C stories that will dovetail in the last act of the show. That seems to be what they are evolving into here. And we'll see if that is what feels like what they're deliberately trying to do next season.
Well, let's start talking about it so we can talk about how it is successful or unsuccessful at doing so in this episode. Listeners, it's successful.
I've already mentioned the fact that Kermit seems genuinely, legitimately excited when he does his special guest star, Ms. Merman, in the O.
It's the Muppet Show with our very special guest star, Ms. Ethel Merman!
And then we have Fozzie doing a joke, talking about going to a diet doctor, a phrase I've never heard before, but, you know, when you're trying
usually a dietitian.
Mm-hmm. Now, maybe that's a temporal thing. Maybe that phrase dietitian didn't exist in 1976, or perhaps it's, again, the labored joke writers trying to make sure that everybody, no matter what, understands the concept.
Yeah.
But the great bit about this is that after he tells the joke, he then isn't quite sure that it lands and then reaches down at his feet and picks up his script to double check it.
And then the curtains close, Kermit runs on, does his introduce the guest star part of the song, and Fozzie pokes his head out from behind the curtain with the notes, throws them back on the ground, and then ducks behind the curtain again. I loved this.
Yeah. We've talked in the last couple episodes about an escalation in Frank Oz upstaging and not being satisfied. This is a heavy Frank episode.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every backstage and onstage segment has Frank in it, with one or two exceptions. And the only other prominent Muppeteer besides Jim Henson is Jerry Nelson, gets two or three key segments. But the other traditional company Muppeteers get almost no action in the course of this show, which I thought was interesting without being able to guess as to why that was. But for example, we had a lot of Hilda and Janice in a previous episode. We've had runners where it felt like they were trying to give the other performers a focus. And this feels like this is Frank's show, if that's what they're doing. If they're doing a rotation of each of the other performers, sort of gets to be the main character or main characters over the course of the episode, that feels like this might have been Frank's run, or he just was steamrolling. And to that end, when Dave Goles has a chance to do something, we don't get a new Dave Goles moment in the O. We get a repeat of something that's had before. When did the green frackle pop up before?
It was in the Ben Vereen episode.
Okay.
So, question, as you mentioned, this is the one where the green frackle pops up and then hits Gonzo with his mallet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've already counted this as a hit.
Oh.
Do I count it again?
I mean, gosh, that's a massive philosophical question.
Isn't it?
I feel like even though it's not a new moment, in the continuity of the show, we're not supposed to know that it's not a new moment.
I did count it.
Good.
But I wanted to bring it up because if, you know, audience, if you feel like I shouldn't count it, let us know and I will ignore you. But I will listen.
You will be listened to and dismissed accordingly.
Yes.
After that, in front of the curtain, this is where Kermit is quite clear to say that he is honored to have one of the giants of the Broadway stage. But before he's able to get too far into this, Piggy rushes in and interrupts by saying that she is going to be riding on the coattails of Ethel Merman's splendor by doing a medley of Merman numbers.
Which Kermit doesn't seem too pleased with, because we have Ethel Merman here, so why would Piggy need to do that medley herself?
It's an interesting character note. We'll get into Piggy's relationship with Merman and when we do the Merman segments in the second third of the podcast, but I thought it was interesting that they didn't choose to play Piggy as jealous, which is how the angle has been in the past with other singer and female stars. Piggy doesn't see her as competition totally.
She views her as a legend and mm-hmm. someone to learn from, not someone that she could compete with.
But she could have leaned into it more of saying, I know the audience would prefer to hear me do the songs for which Merman was famous. And that's not the way they push it.
Mm-hmm. But before they get into Ethel Merman,
yes.
Kermit introduces the first act, which is two tube-like creatures dancing to the song Java.
Java, which originally appeared on Al Hurt's 1964 album Honey on the Horn, which is, you know, supposed to sound like the golden melodic trumpet, but sounds weird. This sketch originally appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show in November 1966 and has been done a number of times. This is a Frank Oz creation.
Hmm.
Frank designed these Muppets and basically came up with the action of this sketch. So while Jim Henson introduced this on The Ed Sullivan Show, or was name-checked by Sullivan when he was introduced, this is actually more of a Frank piece of weirdness and lunacy than it is the normal face of the Muppets.
I really liked the big tube Muppet and the way it's constructed with the eyes, because it's circular. I don't understand how Frank can control it, because it like rolls in place, but the feet never rotate, it appears.
That's right, because the feet are symmetrical 360 degrees. And so it gives you the illusion that at one point in the third act of this dance, the tube basically spins so that the eyes go all the way around its taint to come back around on top.
I would have gone with meridian, maybe.
Your word is much better. And yeah, it's an interesting piece of choreography. It might not be the right word, but, you know, the awareness of the fun physicality of this tube with eyes and feet.
But it also, because of the way it's constructed, the tube often rotated just slightly, so where the eyes looked like they were looking at the feet to make sure it was doing the right thing.
Right.
And I really like that little detail. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but it worked for me.
I think it was. I think it had a very deliberate attempt at making it as much of a creature as possible. And then if the feet had just moved, but the eyes had never really done anything. And they weren't googly eyes. They weren't bouncy.
No. Yeah, I thought so at first too, but no, they were static. I really enjoyed this.
Pete, I have something that I assume you're going to at. This is on the Muppet Show LP.
Hmm.
This is a totally wordless sketch that is all visual action, and yet they include it verbatim with all of the original laughs from the soundtrack, where if you haven't seen this sketch, it's just a series of squeeze sound effects and laughs to a good jazz tune.
Yeah. We've talked about before stand-up records and how listening to those, you hear the laughs for the physical bits, and that's why you then want to go see the comedian live to find out what is happening during that act out. And this seems like the extreme version of that.
But also, in a world where syndication and reruns are not certain, you would have gotten this album and been excited to maybe one day, maybe never, see what this was. I think this is literally the reverse. I think this is, you had to have seen this when it went live in order to understand why this track was funny. And if not, you're missing out, kid.
Yeah, truly wild. I also wonder if Java was in the public domain, so they didn't have to pay for the music rights.
I mean, with a 1964 original recording, it doesn't seem like
probably
it.
Probably not.
I think they were just so enamored of it, they thought that there was something fun and jouncy and energizing about it that helped make the record flow and stay up.
It is simple enough that if you have seen it, listening to the song, you can see the dance very clearly.
Correct.
So I do understand that aspect of it. But yeah, you're right. If you haven't seen this, then you're going to have no idea what it is.
And that was my circumstance for a really long time, because I had the record album as a kid, and it wasn't for ages until I saw this and then rejoiced in being able to know what the heck was going on. And is one of the reasons why I think I love this sketch so much. Is it the music and all of the action was pre-programmed in my audio memory. And so when it finally happened, it was the snap of closure, the realization of, oh my gosh, that's what actually happens. That it has therefore stayed with me in both sets of memories. The original memory of listening to it over and over again, and then the emotional memory of discovering what it meant.
I do want to talk about or mention that the big tube hits the little tube four times during the sketch. So there are four more hits right there. So we're already up to five in the first 5 minutes of the show.
And then while we carefully track explosions as a way of ending a sketch, I don't think we've ever classified the kind of steam jet gun blasts that have happened in various extraterrestrial and monster episodes as explosions.
I have not. You are correct. The steam blasts I do not count as explosions.
But that's how this sketch ends, is that
that's a good point.
It's exactly basically how the You Are My Sunshine sketch ended the previous with the Fazoobs. I think that probably Jim Henson might have classified these under the same architecture as that's a funny way to end the sketch, but we haven't been counting them. I'm not saying we should. I'm just saying I think probably it is the same beat, even if it doesn't count.
Well, I will say this once again in this episode to the listeners. If you want me to start counting these as explosions, I'm open to doing so, but I will not be going back.
So if you can provide Peter with the work of everything we've missed.
But I will, going forward, count steam blasts as explosions if that is what the listeners decide. Again, going forward.
At the end of that, after the summary micro-destruction by the little tube, Statler and Waldorf are in the box, and Statler doesn't have his hearing aid turn on, which leads to some supposedly comic misunderstandings between the two.
This is fun. Classic comedy.
Yeah, except the ending. Where Statler says, what he hears or thinks he hears is there's going to be a raid.
Why don't you turn up your hearing aid?
There's going to be a raid? Well, let's get out of here.
And runs into the pillar of the box, mashing his face up in the least convincing, oh my gosh, we got to get out of here run ever. Like the velocity of it doesn't match what he thinks he should be doing. Because then he turns back around with a squashed face and is no longer trying to run. As Muppet action to produce a squash-faced person that we can laugh at, fine. But as a psychological in-character moment of what he would have done if he thought there was a raid, doesn't work.
I disagree with the fact that he then just squishes his face, looks at the camera, and then sits back down, essentially. But I think if you thought there was going to be a raid and you ran into a pole, squished your face, you would then continue running in a different direction or
yeah,
something like that.
Exactly.
So... okay, yeah, I'm there with you with your general complaint, but I still really liked him running into the pole. So much so, we might be talking about it again later.
From there, we go to our first backstage, and again, this is what I started to notice, that there is a lot of very specific movement in the backstage arena that feels like they're making an attempt at having the backstage be what's going on between production numbers. And so we have the Big Muppet being carried out on a stretcher and Kermit commenting on it before leading into the runner of Fozzie and his agent.
What Kermit says to him is our alternate cute cute.
It's true.
He says, nice, nice number.
I wondered if you were going to catch that.
I did, because again, I made the mistake thinking that nice, nice was the thing episodes ago. So now it is what I am tracking as well as cute cute. We'll see which one comes out on top in the long run of the series.
Yes, this is essentially just a little bit of setup. Like, there aren't that many jokes in this segment, and it doesn't really have rising action so much as it is Fozzie introducing the concept of what the runner is going to be.
So much so that the first backstage sequence and the first Statler and Waldorf were cut from Nickelodeon.
Well, that's bizarre.
Yeah, the Statler and Waldorf seems weird to me. But the first backstage sequence, you really don't know because they then reset up the agent when he shows up later. Mm-hmm. So whether they were saving time or what, I don't know, but not in the episode.
Also, that weirds me out in terms of, in general, my experience with the Nickelodeon reruns is that because they were on Nick Jr. and they had fewer ads, that's where they were putting segments back in. That's why the UK spots were re-included. Was to make the episodes as long as possible for the Tiny Tots without commercial interruption. Mm-hmm. The idea that therefore they would need to edit it out in order to get the time back down strikes me as deeply odd. So unless there was content in here that somebody felt was objectionable, then...
yeah, because they're all standard 26-ish minutes.
Right.
So it's not like this one ran 28 or something like that.
But from there, Kermit goes in front of the curtain.
He says that everyone wanted to do a duet with her, including him. So he's in the next number. So he's got to introduce it and then run behind the curtain.
This is a fairly lengthy number with a lot of details, so we'll get into it later.
And afterwards, Statler and Waldorf come back. Statler makes an old joke at Waldorf's expense.
The second backstage segment is after Statler and Waldorf. Fozzie reintroduces the agent, which is good if the previous segment had a chance of getting cut, but otherwise felt like a piece of useless exposition. The agent turns out to be a top hat, ankles, and shoes named Irving Bazaar. Fozzie tells Kermit, don't make fun of his height, he's sensitive to it. And in a staggering piece of unprofessionalism, Kermit just makes fun of his height until Irving claps back, at which point the frog reveals that he has incredibly thin skin and can dish it but can't take it out.
Which we've seen evidence of in other episodes as well.
Hey, who else do you handle? Rich Little? Tiny Tim?
I wouldn't handle you, I'd get what?
Yeah, this was good setup for what's to come.
Yeah, it's a decent setup for what's going to happen in the next two backstage segments, but it should have been the first segment.
Mm-hmm.
Because aside from a couple of short jokes and Kermit freaking out, this doesn't advance the backstage story really at all.
I totally understand why Nickelodeon cut the first bit. It was unnecessary and barely had jokes in it. And this one at least sets up the game.
But let me counter with this. Mm-hmm. This episode doesn't have any traditional Muppet segments in it.
It's true.
It's the only episode, according to the trivia track, in the whole first season that doesn't have an At the Dance. Mm-hmm. But also, we don't have a vet's hospital. We don't have a Muppet News broadcast. We don't have a Muppet Labs. We have no traditional onstage segments except Fozzie doing stand-up. Otherwise, everything else is absent. And if they had cut one of these backstage segments, they could have done something else to make this feel more like The Muppet Show.
I wonder if, because all of the Ethel sections are very highly choreographed for the most part. I wonder if they were just like, we'll just do a backstage that we can just have fun with, get done. We don't need to really work it out. But wild speculation on our parts.
Wild speculation on our parts. But also, there's a degree of complexity in choreography to the UK spot as well.
Yes,
which we can go on to talk about at this time, because the UK spot is a heavily piece of blue screened filming where you have Statler and Waldorf peering at a mouse dancing and singing in a cup of tea. And the mouse that comes up out of the cup is on a blue screen element. Mm-hmm. But Statler and Waldorf's reaction to her dance and song is very well timed. And so the two puppeteers knew exactly what was going to be done in the song and had bits done with it, even though it was shot on a separate plate. Mm-hmm. And so the timing of that and the complexity of that might have been part of the technical element that led them to say, okay, we can't do this other stuff.
Yeah, they had to record that twice, because I'm sure they must have been watching a video of the mouse performance, so that way they had it timed.
Very briefly on this song, this is Don't You Sugar Me by Walt Kelly. This is in Songs of the Pogo from the Pogo comic strip. This is actually a song that I performed when I was in Doug Schwartz's local production of I Go Pogo. It has a weird burlesque striptease cadence to the music. Mm-hmm. A lot of bomp, bomp, ba-dum stuff.
Don't stir me, boy, or try to spoon.
All of which is very strange to be done with a tiny mouse in a nightdress. I loved the amount of work that went into making Statler and Waldorf interesting background to Miss Mousy. I thought that the tension of her effectively singing a striptease number while on a children's show and being fully clothed was also very weird. I thought that the size was great.
Yeah, for a,
how tiny she was.
For a UK spot, this was definitely more elaborate than most of them are.
Uh-huh.
Usually being single one shots, with the exception of the ghost one.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything that's been this involved.
The only other one that springs to mind is Rolf as Sherlock Holmes was both long and had multiple cuts and characters. The last piece of this is that the previous Ethel Merman segment contains a reference to this mouse.
Oh, Hilda.
Yes, Miss Merman.
I don't wish to complain, but there's a mouse in my dressing room.
Oh, yes. We'll move her tomorrow. But for now, it's the only place she has to change.
She says, oh, yeah, she's a member of the band. So right before the ad break, we have the setup to this sketch. So to cut this sketch, first of all, it's weird to do internal show references across an ad break. But also to therefore have a moment that U.S. audiences just plain old didn't see, the mouse that was talked about.
I didn't even make that connection that this was the mouse that they were talking about, but that is clearly what they were doing. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, they've definitely referred to other things in the dressing room sharing, and then we don't see it.
Yeah.
Or referencing other acts that we don't actually see. So that wouldn't have been completely unheard of for any audience member, whether they're U.S. or U.K.
If you hadn't seen this number, it would just fit in with the normal practice of there's weirdness that happened off camera that we didn't see.
Mm-hmm. After that, we get the talk spot with Ethel Merman, so we'll return to that in a little bit. And then we have Statler and Waldorf talking from the balcony again, and Statler makes a fruit pun.
Ah, she and Kermit make a nice pair.
Well, she certainly is a peach.
And then Kermit introduces Australian puppeteer Richard Bradshaw, performing some shadow puppetry.
And again, one of the weirder aspects of this show, this is fairly long, and I assume you have the notes on that. Because it's so completely silent, one of the main aspects of this shadow puppetry is the soundtrack.
It is just barely over 2.5 minutes.
Okay.
For the whole thing. And it seems longer than that.
So I take it you did not enjoy this.
Oh, no, I actually loved it. It just seems like it was a solid bit.
So that wasn't a, oh my gosh, this was interminable and I hated it. This was, there was so much going on, it felt long.
Yeah. And also, it's very slow paced. There's essentially 6 jokes in it, but each one takes a while to do. So it feels like it's longer than it is.
It happens in 2 halves, and it's 3 different animal cutout puppets placed up against a screen with a bright green light behind it. The first puppet is an ostrich, the second is a tiny mouse, and the third is a rotund hippopotamus. And in the first half, they're walking up a ladder to go down a slide. And in the second half, they're walking up a ladder to go across a tightrope.
And we see how those things interact with each animal. And in between the 2 segments, Statler and Waldorf interrupt it to ask for more and then seem somewhat upset when they are heard.
One of perhaps the best Statler and Waldorf moments I've ever seen. I really enjoyed the essential idea of...
Oh, good grief, they heard me!
We were being polite, and now we got what we asked for.
I did not count the 10 seconds of Statler and Waldorf in the overall music, because there was no music when that was happening.
Thank you, I was wondering. So what appealed to you about this? Because it is very out of sync with The Muppet Show in general. It feels like a very strange cul-de-sac for the show to have gone down. And again, when we have so few regular segments in the show, and when we have an amazing legendary musical performer who can hold her own, it seems like a very strange choice to have inserted this in as programming.
Yeah, this episode basically has 2 guest stars because of the name check of Richard Bradshaw. I assume that this took the place of one of those other regular segments.
Almost certainly.
Yeah, I liked it because it reminded me of something I would have seen in like a Hanna-Barbera cartoon. It was cartoony and fun. I enjoyed how every animal had a clear interaction with the situation. The physics of every animal seemed realistic to what it would have done. And it was really well puppeteered. Also, even though this sometimes annoys me, I found the fact that you could see the poles and occasionally his hands behind the light box was very funny.
See, I actually assumed that was, if you didn't like the sketch, that was going to be the part that you liked, based on the way in which you pay such keen attention to looking for black-clad puppeteers against a black background, that being able to see behind the curtain, essentially, to see the process, I think is one of the things that generally makes you happy.
That is very true. Yeah, so maybe it was that piece that made it. But no, I just thought it was fun.
I found it incredibly charming, and I was very impressed with the amount of effort that went into the puppeteering and to give the shadow puppets personality. But I was disappointed in how much of that personality, some of it was in the movement and the puppeteering, the way the mouse's tail was designed to waggle so that when you got tiny motions of the stick that controlled it, that it would have an additional piece of real life physics built into it in order to give it a little bit more life and liveliness. And I thought that that was incredibly well engineered. Unfortunately, most of the actual humor that reached me as an audience member came from the soundtrack. And because the soundtrack was doing a lot of the heavy lifting, and because the soundtrack was both a hyper-engineered score that went along with each movement of the puppets, and had a, I assume, totally fake juiced laugh track, I then tried to picture watching it without any sound, and would it have been successful? And because it wasn't, I therefore felt manipulated. That essentially, it's two fat jokes and some good puppeteering.
Yeah, but that's, if you were to watch a movie and it didn't have the sweetening of punches in an action scene, it would seem ludicrous. So I don't think you can hold that needed sound design against something, because that's what all motion picture is.
I actually think about this all the time in terms of soundtrack, add-on of ADR and of Foley effects in order to create the additional sonic illusion to make me convinced that the thing that I'm watching is realistic. That regularly takes me out of movies. That is one of my weird psychological sticking points. Of sometimes I'm like, God, this is beautiful. I love movies. Movies are so wonderful. And the amount of work that went into it. And then sometimes I'm like, yeah, but if all the sound effects were taken out of this, this would be the dumbest thing in the world. And why am I putting so much time and emotional weight on this?
But on the other hand, if all of the real sound effects were left in, like when two characters are walking on a beach and wind is whipping through their hair, if you were to use the true sound that was recorded on the day, it would be unlistenable.
It would be unlistenable. You'd hear the crunch, crunch, crunch of the boom operator walking alongside them. It would be hilariously... Yes, it would. Everything about it wouldn't work. It is only the artifice that makes it emotionally enjoyable. And sometimes that bothers me, and sometimes I'm impressed by the amount of craft that goes into fixing things afterwards so that they are successful illusions. With this particular one, I think it's because sort of what you're talking about in terms of the craft of the shadow puppetry and that you can sort of see the hands. I could picture this in a fair, seeing it live, seeing it being done in a children's tent for a live audience. I could picture it like a Punch and Judy show or at a puppetry convention where Jim Henson found this guy in the first place. And because of that, I wanted to imagine what it would be like to sit there and watch it be done live. And because of that, I realized that the soundtrack and the sound effects and the laughter might not have been there.
I absolutely disagree with that, because if this was being done at a children's theater, the music underscore and the sound effects would have been being played on at least a boombox.
I can't imagine the sound effects happening as part of the soundtrack unless the puppeteer was so well timed that he did it exact. I can picture the soundtrack being like a thing that would happen underneath, but the fact that it was juiced, that you got the sproing whenever.
Yeah, I think that's all timed.
You don't think those sproings were put in afterwards. You think the puppeteer was doing it because he knew that in 3 seconds that sound was going to happen at that exact moment. So he had to have the puppets walk and move and pause until they got to the bounce.
Yeah, you don't get a guest spot on The Muppet Show unless you're a world-class puppeteer.
Okay.
Not that I actually have even heard of Richard Bradshaw's name before this moment, but I'm just saying Jim Henson doesn't give you a spot on his show unless you deserve a spot on his show.
And for you, it worked.
Yes, very much so.
And for me, it worked, except when I started analyzing it. So after that, we go back to the next piece of Backstage Runner, and we have Irving starting in on his hard pitch to increase Fozzie's pay by 100%. And before this can escalate, Piggy comes in, full of love for the frog, but is distracted by the presence of Irving.
And then Irving says some things that do not hold up well in the Me Too era.
Hey, how you doing, baby? Kiddo, sweetheart, not bad. Looking for a pig. Want me to handle you?
I already have an agent. Short stuff.
I don't want to be your agent. I just want to handle you.
To which Piggy rightfully gives him the business, giving him one powerful hi-ya.
The trivia track has two things to say about this. The first of which is that this is Piggy Karate Chop number 17, which has been a long time since we brought one of those up, which makes me think that I have either not been paying attention to the trivia track or there have been a bunch out of sequence that I have missed out on.
Mm.
But more importantly, I wanted to point out that the trivia track is keen to point out that Irving Bazaar is based on actual real-life agent Irving Lazar, who was alive from 1907 to 1993 and who handled Cole Porter as his client, which seems to be the connective tissue between the Ethel Merman and his appearance here. To have a character created as an homage, and that character is then a lecherous jerk who makes advances on Miss Miggy?
A tiny lecherous jerk.
Seems like a very strange decision. And so yeah. I liked the blasé way in which the trivia track was like, this is an honorarium to, and I'm like, this guy's a creep. I'm not sure anybody would say this is an actual homage.
According to the Wikia, Irving Lazar's other client included future Muppet Show guest star Gene Kelly. So the fact that they did this to him and then later reached out and said, hey, can we have Gene?
means he must not have minded.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, family show is what Andy Zaltzman would say about this. We've now had a mock strip tease by a mouse, and we've had two legs in a hat offering to, quote, handle, unquote, Miss Piggy. In a very clear innuendo-esque way. I was surprised. Let's put it that way.
1977, man. Different time.
But still on Disney Plus, yep. Nobody worried about Cuddy. And on Nickelodeon Jr., they cut the other scenes and not this one.
Kermit then introduces Fozzie for his comedy routine. I have a question.
I am going to fail you.
You also don't know who Maxie the Bear is?
I have no idea who Maxie the Bear is.
Ladies and gentlemen, the funniest bear since Maxie, Mr. Fozzie Bear!
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, yes, yes, yes!
What does a quick Google give you?
Oh, Maxie the Polar Bear is a Woody the Woodpecker cartoon character. He's the polar bear in Chilly Willy segments.
All right.
Thanks, Google.
But this is all a lead into a lengthy Fozzie bit, where we have Fozzie engaged in another heckler back and forth with the audience. And this time starts off with a number of newly created audience shots, enabling him to interact with first his cousin in the audience, which is basically him with a bowler hat instead of his rumpled fedora.
The bear's funny, huh? He's my cousin.
And then a Jim Henson voiced big-nosed human puppet, who the wiki refers to as Leo, and who the trivia track wants to point out is the spokesperson Muppet that Henson used in the Muppet Meetings films, which reminded me, that's where I'd seen him before. He's the guy that's in the short film that they made when they were initially pitching the Muppet Show to CBS. There's the bit where he goes, and the laughing producer George Slaughter will make millions, and you will make millions, and CBS will have a four share. And like, I was like, oh yeah, I recognize him now. And in a back and forth between the hecklers in the box, his cousin in the audience, Leo in the audience, Fozzie eventually says, all right, I'm going to turn my back. When I turn back around, I only want real Fozzie Bear fans to be in the audience. Turns back and literally everybody except Statler and Waldorf has left.
Sad Fozzie.
Pete, you're a consummate checker out of who is in the audience shots. How much attention did you pay to these?
Only somewhat. I did see in the trivia of this episode that there are some mistakes made. And also, who was in the
There audience. Are lots of mistakes made. For example, the trivia track points out that in the UK spot, this is the only time so far in the Muppet Show we've seen Miss Mousie, except in the audience shots. And she's in the audience, full-sized, able to sit in a chair and much bigger than she is in a cup of tea. She starts off in the second row in the middle left, and then they cut back and she's three seats down along towards the right, having swapped with Prairie Dawn. And Fozzie's cousin is no longer in the audience. So when Fozzie turns back around and says, wait, even my cousin left? He'd been gone, Fozzie. He took off after he delivered his punchline. Statler and Waldorf said he was even funnier. Boom. He took his victory and was out.
He truly is the better bear family member because he knows when to get out.
The last piece of continuity error that I specifically noticed was that Mana Mana is in the front row. Mm-hmm. And when we have the last shot of Fozzie turning back around to a mostly empty house, we see Mana Mana running out from the second row. So maybe he went to the right, got confused, and then looped back around. Or they just didn't care to pay attention to where all the Muppets were from shot to shot.
Yeah, and I also didn't pay attention to the next audience shot we get later to see. Like, it would make sense, those differences with them all leaving, and then once they eventually come back.
They're in different
spots. If they
seats.
Were in different spots,
yeah.
Fine. But I did not pay attention that closely. Then we get the last backstage segment where Irving, Bazaar, and Kermit successfully negotiate on a contract for Fozzie. Kermit negotiates in a similar style to how he did with Scooter back in the first Scooter episode. But this time he's on the winning side. But also, how does Scooter make more money than Fozzie?
I think it's one of those traditional things where he was able to pay Scooter because he wasn't paying Fozzie at all.
Then we have two more Ethel Merman segments, and then the last Statler and Waldorf, which is the other angle of Statler and Waldorf, and Statler's itching, and he doesn't know why, and Waldorf suggests that the show is starting to get under his skin.
All right. Well, that's the running order of everything that is not specifically Merman related, with a little bit of Merman tossed in for context. But let's delve deep into the career, the notoriety, the reputation, and the history of Ethel Merman, starting by going through some trivia questions to provide you with some mix of false and real data. And then we'll be able to talk about her segments and how successful they were. Question number one. Ethel Merman was born Ethel Agnes Zimmerman in 1908. Merman was created as a shortened form of her last name. Ethel was raised in which faith? A. Episcopalian. She was a devout and faithful Christian, and she would occasionally comment that you knew she wasn't Jewish because her original name of Zimmerman was spelled with two N's at the end of it. B. Jewish, but in the traditional Hollywood way of never acknowledging it, changing her name, referring to Temple as church in the press, and only finally admitting that she was in fact Jewish while playing Gypsy Rose Lee in 1959. Or C, atheist. Her parents were both non-practicing, but she converted to Judaism when marrying Bob Levitt in 1941.
I have no concept. So I'm just going to take a stab in the dark and go B.
No, she was not Jewish. One of the many strange things that swirls around Ethel Merman as a figure is that a large number of people have adopted her to their focused causes after her death. And a lot of people interpret her as a self-hating Jew, when in fact she was an Episcopalian for her entire life, and any Jewishness has been projected onto her over the course of her career and afterwards.
Well, I apologize for doing the same.
Question number two. Merman's vocal style is distinctive and unlike most singers, which led to her working with celebrated songwriters who were excited to work with her unusual voice. Which legendary musician commenting on her delivery is untrue? A. In her first Broadway musical, composer George Gershwin approached her and asked if she knew what she was doing. When she replied no, he quickly said, well, never go near a singing teacher, because he was so impressed that she was untrained and so perfect. B. Lyricist Oscar Hammerstein of composer team Rodgers and Hammerstein said, you have to have the best lyrics for Ethel because they're going to be heard in every corner of the theater, so you can't hand off a half-baked rhyme. Or C, Luciano Pavarotti praised her for having no passaggio, the transition between chest and head voices, where one changes registers while singing. When she was told this, Merman said she had no idea what this meant. Two of those things is true, one is false.
I'm going to say, based off of the connection between A and C of her being untrained, that B would be the false answer.
That's correct.
Yes, finally.
Question number three. Ethel once told the Associated Press, if you don't exist in, for, and through the movies, you don't exist at all. And Merman was lucky enough to, after having started off on Broadway, go on to play the same roles that she originated on stage in film adaptations of the same works. However, she missed out on a key one. which of the three was the role she did not reprise on film? A. Anything Goes, with music and lyrics by Cole Porter, which opened on Broadway in 1934 and was made into a film in 1936. B. Call Me Madam, with music and lyrics by Irving Berlin, which opened on Broadway in 1950 and was made into a movie released in 1956. Or C. Gypsy, with lyrics by Stephen Sondheim and music by Julie Stein, which opened on Broadway in 1959 and was made into a film released in 1962.
I'm going to go with A, because they mention Irving Berlin in the show, and your first answer referenced her playing in Gypsy, but maybe that's because she was in the show, but not the movie, but I'm still sticking with A.
No, unfortunately, C is the correct answer. She was not in the film version of Gypsy, a thing that she was very disheartened about, and so she threw herself into the promotion of the film It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, saying that it was a far better movie than The Gypsy. She couldn't have been scheduled to be in both, and she was much more happy to be in this. It was much more fun, and in general, she received a lot of correspondence from people saying that Rosalind Russell in the film version was not nearly as good as she was. Question number 4. Merman was married 4 times between the ages of 32 and 66. Her final marriage to Ernest Borgnine is legendary for lasting 116 days from wedding to divorce, but only 41 days if you count from wedding to legal separation. In her 1978 autobiography, Merman infamously dedicates an entire chapter to the marriage. Which of the following is true about that chapter? A. In response to the LA Times' claim that the marriage lasted 38 days, Merman lists 38 rumors about why the marriage broke up, including that he hit her, he was sexually abusive, that she couldn't deal with the fact that he was a Democrat, that she was secretly gay, etc. She denies all of these, but doesn't provide any explanation as to why. B. She explains that the whirlwind courtship broke down during their honeymoon, when she discovered they had radically different opinions about money and fame. She wanted to spend lavishly but didn't care about recognition, whereas he was picky, wanted freebies, and was jealous of notoriety, including the fact that she might overshadow him as a couple. Or C. The book has a chapter page, a blank page following it, and that's it.
I want C to be true, so I'm going to go with C.
Correct.
Yes.
In one of the 2 biographies that was written later after her death, there continues to be speculation, and some of the things I mentioned are amongst those speculation, but she never provided friends or family with any official accounting as to what happened.
Well, we support wild speculation on this podcast, so...
And for our final question, we turn once again to Pete's least favorite segment of the podcast, 6 Degrees in 60 Seconds, or The Henson Connection. I'm going to give Pete Ethel Merman's top 4 most known for on IMDb, along with a selection of cast members of those in case he is unfamiliar with the cast of those movies. He then has 60 seconds to use the names I give him, or anybody else if he does know those movies, to try and connect Ethel Merman to Jim Henson in under 6 connections. Ethel Merman's top 4 are It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, starring Mickey Rooney, Spencer Tracy, Jonathan Winters, Phil Suvers, Sid Caesar, Milton Berle, and a whole bunch of other people. Call Me Madam, the film version of her Broadway show, which stars Donald O'Connor, who you've seen in Singin' in the Rain. Airplane, starring Leslie Nielsen, Robert Hayes, Julie Hagerty, Robert Stack, and many others. There's No Business Like Show Business, also featuring Donald O'Connor, and also starring Marilyn Monroe. So with those names, or any others from those films that you can remember, please connect Ethel Merman to Jim Henson, starting now.
Was or was not Uncle Milty in one of the Muppet movies? That's my question. I feel like he was, but I can't remember, because it's been years since I've seen them. Except for Muppets Take Manhattan, of course, which is by far the best, and the one I watch the most often. I also want to say, wasn't the nun in Airplane someone of note? Wasn't that Jodie Foster or something?
It's not Jodie Foster. You've got 25 seconds to decide.
But it is someone who I feel like has been in the Muppet movie. Can I connect Kareem Abdul-Jabbar?
10 seconds.
I don't think I can. Good thing I already wrote down that I got two things right.
2-1.
So clearly all of my wavering was incorrect. I did not land on anything.
You didn't say anything. You never made a claim. You said, what if, but you didn't say.
But I will contend that if one of those is the right answer, I will take that win.
I disagree. I think you didn't ever say Milton Berle is in the Muppet movie. You said, I think Milton Berle is in one of the Muppet movies, but I don't remember which one. And I don't think it's Muppets Take Manhattan. And then you moved on to other people. So you never made a claim. Therefore, you ran out the clock.
I'd give myself a half point. If that ends up being true, is it true?
It's true. It's true. Milton Berle is the car salesman that sells them the big giant jalopy instead of the Studebaker, is the person that employs Sweetums, which is why he runs after them for the rest of the movie.
See, I remember that Sweetums part. I don't remember Uncle Milty.
That is Uncle Milty. So congratulations, but I don't think you get that point.
I don't care what you say. I'm the stats keeper. I hope I lose by half a point. I'll lose by way more than half a point, audience.
I had forgotten that Milton Berle was in the Muppet movie. The best one that I was able to come up with was that Mickey Rooney was in Breakfast at Tiffany's with Audrey Hepburn, who was in Charade with James Coburn, who was in the Muppet movie.
Mm.
So that was four connections. But even better than that is that Leslie Nielsen was in Dracula Dead and Loving It with Mel Brooks, who's in the Muppet movie. So that's three connections. So yeah, your Milton Berle connection is absolutely the shortest. If you'd actually remembered it, you would have gotten a great point. Back to Ethel Agnes Zimmerman. Let's talk about her specific appearances and references and work on this episode of The Muppet Show. We have three major bits and a blackout. The first major bit is, as Kermit says, a medley of all her songs where he and everybody else is excited to sing along with her. And it's Ethel sitting in front of a makeup mirror at a desk, and the various Muppets appear effectively as her reflection in the makeup mirror or next to her as she's sitting there. And goes through a bunch of songs that she would have sung in various productions. I can run down the list if you want.
I could also run down the list if you want.
Well, let's alternate then.
Okay.
Starts with You're the Top by Cole Porter from Anything Goes with Kermit.
See, here's what I don't have, what it's from or who wrote it.
Well, then you give me the other bits and I'll fill in the details you don't have.
Up next was Friendship with Fozzie.
From Du Bois Was a Lady by Cole Porter. I'm sorry, Du Barry. Du Barry Was a Lady.
Then after that, we have De Lovely with Scooter and Gonzo.
Also by Cole Porter, from Red Hot and Blue originally, but then imported into Anything Goes.
Then we have Together Wherever We Go with the Two-Headed Singer.
By Sondheim and lyrics by Sondheim. As I pointed out earlier, the music is by somebody I am less familiar with, Julie Stein in Gypsy.
After that, we have You're Just in Love with Uncle Deadly.
Which is our first Irving Berlin, by the way. Despite the fact that this seems like it's an extension of Piggy saying, well, we'll do a medley, we'll call it a tribute to Irving Berlin. The first half of this is all Cole Porter.
Or Sondheim.
Three Cole Porters, one Sondheim, and now we finally get to Irving Berlin. And this is from Call Me Madam.
Then you have the big portion of Anything You Can Do with Miss Piggy.
This is from Annie Get Your Gun and is also by Irving Berlin.
And then lastly, we have everyone joining in as a chorus for Mutual Admiration Society.
We belong to a mutual club. at Monk's Great Chimp Society.
Miss Merman and me.
That is from a musical I hadn't ever heard of. Even while looking at her productions, it did not jump out at me. I believe it's called Happy Hunting from 1956. It works as a good closer because it feels like the kind of thing that you would all sing together. You know, Mutual Admiration Society, we should all join in on it. But compared to anything you can do, which is a showstopper, and which was literally performed 3 times in Annie Get Your Gun. Like, it's performed as a song, and then it's reprised twice in the original productions of it. I think it's weird that they rapped with something that doesn't have the staying power as some of the other pieces.
I just looked it up, and that song was previously performed by Rolf and Jimmy Dean in episode 219 of The Jimmy Dean Show.
Huh. So it's got some previous form in terms of Henson liking it.
Yeah, this was fun. She was clearly having a good time throughout the whole thing. I don't really have much to say about this other than it was enjoyable.
Just 2 more notes on this. Piggy hitting the high note in Anything You Can Do is impressive.
Mm-hmm.
But also interesting that therefore they chose to not give Ethel Merman the victory part. They let Piggy play Annie Oakley so that she gets the win of out-singing her. And Ethel just says, you know, just rolls with it. Just smiles and says, yeah, you sure hit that before moving on.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't. Yeah.
But the other thing that's interesting is the added in applause happens whenever each new song starts, which means the Muppets get the applause.
Mm.
And that struck me as a weird note. Now, of course, she didn't hear that because it was all added in afterwards, but it is a strange accidental oddity to the overall production.
But that's something that would happen in
yes.
a medley song like this.
Correct.
Someone would walk on stage and you'd go, yay!
But it is bizarre that the realistic application of the laugh track made it so Ethel was getting less applause.
Yeah.
I've touched upon the talk spot, so let's move to that. Mostly, this is Piggy praising Ethel, bringing on a wine glass to toast her, an empty wine glass, which is good on a multiple number of levels, including the part that Frank has Piggy swish that wine glass around with a huge amount of gestures. So if there was anything in it, it would have been gone by the end of her demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
But it also seems to be her basically taking this as an opportunity to hit Ethel up for help as to how can she be a better singer.
To Ethel Merman, a great woman and a great singer whom we can all learn something from. Got any tips?
All that for one free singing lesson?
And so again, this is an interesting tone following on from Kermit and Piggy in front of the curtain at the very beginning, where Piggy isn't necessarily setting themselves up for conflict. The anything you can do, I can do better is good energy. But that's not actually her energy in the bookends of this. Piggy is not being as arrogant as sometimes Piggy is.
I took that as being that the medley is a performance and this is them being themselves.
Yep.
I did like how Ethel brings up the high note again
mm-hmm.
and asks her to do it again so she can give her pointers.
And so that then she can do it better.
Yeah, ultimately getting the win.
Blowing Kermit off the wall and shattering Piggy's wine glass with the force of her note.
And such force that Kermit asks her if she recorded as an air raid siren in the war, and Ethel then hits him for our 6th hit.
Ethel's performance of the hit is kind of fascinating, because she's laughing, she's smiling, and then she decides to be angry and smacks him, and then goes back to being very lackadaisically, sort of looking like I could be here all day.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really enjoyed about Ethel's performance was she was clearly having a blast.
Mm.
She was, as we've discussed before with other guest stars, trying to connect with the Muppets. She was constantly like petting them or touching them or being gentle with them. And this was another one of those moments. She was clearly just having a blast.
In a lot of articles that I found, there was a strange detail that Ethel collected a lot of things and acquired things and was very happy. The point I made in the trivia about her spending money was based on a real detail that she learned from her parents, who told her, don't save your money, don't hoard it, use it. When you are successful, use it to do what you want to feel good. And so she spent her money frequently. But she had her house robbed in 1970 and lost a lot of the things that she had acquired. And one of the biographies pointed out that after that point, she didn't buy things that were precious anymore. She would buy things that were cheap or things at yard sales or thrift stores. She would still acquire things, but she wouldn't acquire things that were irreplaceable. One of the details that came up in articles is that towards the end of her life, she had a huge number of stuffed Muppets on her bed at all times. And there was a thing in New York Times that talked about a Miss Piggy doll sitting on a chair at the foot of her bed. And so I think she must have loved this to a huge degree because she literally surrounded herself with Muppet dolls for the rest of her life.
Nice. I like that. Let's backtrack briefly. In between the medley and the talk spot, we have the blackout sketch.
Mm-hmm.
Where she is complaining to Hilda that there's the mouse from the UK spot in her dressing room. Hilda brushes it off, telling her that the mouse is another star.
Has to change someplace.
And Ethel wonders if this is a show or a zoo, and then Animal shows up, and then Ethel hits Animal for our fifth hit. Oh no, that's our sixth. The talk spot is our seventh.
But it's also interesting that this has Ethel do the same thing of turn on and off the violence.
Mm-hmm.
When Animal shows up, well, first she delivers the post-mouse line to the audience of, is this a show or a zoo? And then when Animal shows up, she looks down the barrel of the camera and says, it's a zoo, looks back at Animal, then expresses fear at the weirdness of this animal, and then hits him on the head when he says, hiya, sweetie, but goes from being nonplussed to scared to then back to normal. And she hits him without any expression of fear or anxiety or rage. She just sort of hits him to hit it.
None of that really tracked or bothered me, I guess. Because compared to other guest stars where we've talked about that disconnect between the rapid shifts in mood or things like that, that take me out of it, I didn't clock any of that with her.
It didn't bother me at all. I wasn't, for whatever reason, I didn't need her to have an emotional through line in this. I didn't need her to be consistent. It was clear that she was hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, I think that's more important to me.
She was doing something because she was playing a part. And sometimes it was clear that she was in the moment, and sometimes it was clear that she was doing a bit. And oftentimes these blackouts, they feel like they're a blurring of that, am I here or am I reading a punchline?
Mm-hmm.
For example, with Phyllis Diller and the pocket camera, that was very clearly not Phyllis being Phyllis Diller in quotes. That was her delivering a joke.
Yep.
But with Ben Vereen, of course, jumping up to the rafters, it's part of an ongoing bit. It's supposed to be part of the reality of Ben Vereen being Ben Vereen. Here, with this particular one, she was somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
She was pretending to be Ethel Merman, but she was also there in order to be scared, and she didn't care about the fact that it wasn't part of her character. She did it when she needed to, and that's it. It was a very strange casualness. Which leads me to our last bit, because this is overwhelmingly both, it's the missing piece of the medley. It's the showstopper number that was left out so that she could do it here. But also, it's an emotional core that reveals how good of a performer she is. Because when she comes down the stairs to comfort Fozzie about having had his contract re-upped so that he still makes nothing, she talks to him about what's great is that you're doing what you love. And then as she's saying that, she goes into the lyrics to There's No Business Like Show Business. And she starts off sort of sing-talks them before she then starts singing. But the emotional resonance that she brings to, for example, the lines,
the opening when your heart beats like a drum, the closing when the customers don't come.
She doesn't just sing that line, she fully emotes it. And she legendarily talks about the fact that she never had a show on Broadway that was a flop. She had a couple of shows that didn't make it to Broadway, that got tried out someplace else, that absolutely didn't land. But there's nothing lacking in genuine delivery in that line. Like, she fills out the emotional resonance of that backstage bit before she goes on to stage so well and so powerfully.
Which is also helped by other Muppets slowly but surely coming out, being like, oh, something big is happening here. Let's go check it out. But not crashing all at once. Just, oh, there's George. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's Wayne and Wanda on the balcony.
This is an escalation of what they set up two production episodes earlier with Valerie Harper. It's basically the same concept. Mm-hmm. But I think Merman pulls it off better here in that, as you talked about, the sort of tactile relationship with the Muppets. Because you also had all of the Muppets sort of in the front of the backstage watching Valerie Harper do her thing. But to have that moment of basically all the Muppets staring at Ethel Merman as she does the song for which she's possibly most famous, and does it in this intimate,
almost motherly way.
Yeah. You really, I mean, first of all, it's another testament to the fact that the Muppets feel real. Like, because mm-hmm. you have all these ping pong and felt eyes staring at her, and yet the sense of reverence for what the opportunity that they get to be in her presence is palpable.
Mm-hmm.
And that shouldn't work, and yet it does. The combination of the lighting and the Muppets, and as you say, the way they slowly come in, but mostly just what she's able to... She's always talked about as somebody who is a big voice, a brassy voice that fills the whole space, but here she's doing modulated Merman, and she's really good at it.
Until she takes to the stage, she has a quick costume change, and now it's all of a sudden a fully produced number, and it's... pedal to the metal.
I assumed you would like this second half of this in part because the really cheesy Broadway bits that they do of having the vans go back and forth in front of her with all the is literally exactly what they do
in Manhattan Melodies.
In Manhattan Melodies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also what they do in the making of the Muppet movie at the end of the Muppet movie. When they have the really cheap cardboard bus for the Electric Mayhem and all their cheap props, all of which have really constantly pissed me off over the course of watching the Muppet films, is you're making a movie, have realistic props, don't have cardboard cutout. You're making a Broadway show, don't have cardboard cutout props, which makes me wonder, maybe actually that's how cheesy Broadway was in the 70s.
Could be.
And I just don't know. So that's what Ethel Merman's episode finally drove home to me, is that maybe my lifetime of criticism of how cheesy both Muppets Take Manhattan and the Muppet movie's presentation of we're finally making our big production looked, maybe that's actually about how good they really were. Either way, it's definitely been Jim Henson's aesthetic since this episode, and he's run with it in two major multi-million dollar film production.
For sure.
So you said, when you said, but then she goes on stage, pedal to the metal, you didn't mean that as a but of, and then the energy drains away because it's no longer intimate.
No, opposite. As you were saying, she was being restrained and holding back, and then, but as soon as she goes on stage, she belts it out. That's the Ethel Merman that we have seen for the rest of this episode, and people who are familiar with Ethel Merman would go, that's the Ethel Merman I know.
And I wonder if that's actually the point of why she was sitting down and why she wasn't being full strident Ethel Merman in the earlier numbers, is so that this feels like a culmination.
Mm-hmm.
To have her stride out in her dress with her giant plumed hat and to be basically doing the gypsy diva stance in the middle of the show, we don't have to swing up and down away from that in the previous numbers. We've been hiding it. We've been keeping it. And now finally we get what we've expected and wanted her to be the whole time.
Yeah, it was great. All of the Ethel Merman sections were great. I mean, we still have one more,
right,
which is actually my least favorite segment of hers.
Mm, because?
So in the outro, Kermit is thanking her for being here, and then Piggy comes on, presents Ethel with a bouquet of roses. This is the one I don't like.
Miss Merman, from all of us to you.
Oh, how kind of you, Miss Piggy. They won't explode, will they?
And then they don't. But nothing through this episode has had, as you mentioned many times, Piggy is usually very jealous of the guest stars. Piggy shows no jealousy during these segments. So why would Ethel think that these would then explode? I wanted it, again, give us 45 years, we'll punch anything out. I feel like this should have been a third high note where Piggy was able to hit it even more powerfully or something like that, showing Ethel, like, I listened to what you said, and now I'm a better performer.
I can't figure out how to write that, to be honest with you, because they would have had to do the note together or something, because otherwise you don't want to take away from a celebration of Ethel. What this was, it's essentially the Muppet performers giving her real roses because they're like, we want you to be appreciated the way you should be on stage. And so it's real flowers. Kermit says it's real flowers for a real lady. But to me, the subtext was this was Jim and Frank giving her real flowers and sort of writing a punchline around it.
And I appreciate them giving her her flowers because they are well deserved. But I just didn't like her doubting that they wouldn't be authentic.
You're right. It doesn't come out of anywhere because there are no previous acts of violence towards Merman.
Ethel even says the word crazy.
This has been the most fun I've had in a long, long time. You know, you really don't have to be crazy to do this show, but it helps.
And then uses the word explode. So if Crazy Harry had popped out and then they shut him down, preventing it to be like, no, 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 you do not treat Ethel Merman this way. I would have liked that more, too.
I mean, Crazy Harry would have come out of nowhere because the only place Crazy Harry shows up in this episode is in the orchestra playing the triangle. I mean, first of all, I wouldn't have liked it because it would have been way too similar to the Ben Vereen bit. And that would have come way too close on the heels of something we just saw. But aside from the fact that it doesn't come out of anywhere, I am glad that that's not the direction they went in. You have talked about the number of hits, and you've talked about Merman being physical and tactile with the Muppets, but I didn't catch any actual Muppet human kisses. With regard to that and other statistics, what do you have for us?
Twice in the episode, Ethel kisses her finger and then touches the nose of a Muppet, but I did not count those. There are no explosions, no actual kisses. I counted 8 hits throughout the episode, and 1 nice. The alternate to the cutes. In terms of music, we have a Broadway star, we have Java, we have Don't Sugar Me, we have the lengthy shadow puppetry, we have a new leader in the clubhouse.
I'm not surprised.
This is the first episode to cross the 50% music mark.
Oh my goodness.
We are at 53.01% music. 14 minutes and 1 second worth of music for a 26 minute and 26 second episode. This is by far the leader. I think the previous one was 47.57%, which I believe was the Twiggy episode.
Who beat out Paul Williams, if I'm not mistaken.
Ben Vereen was the next highest, and then Paul Williams.
Okay.
Speaking of Ben Vereen and Paul Williams, I put Ethel Merman right in between those two.
She took the number 8 spot.
She took the number 8 spot.
I am unsurprised.
She had similar interactions as both of them did in terms of her connection with them. I feel like she was more successful than Ben Vereen was. Basically, her and Paul Williams could probably switch places, depending upon the day. But that spot was open, so I just put her right in.
Which means we now have a complete top 10 in terms of rankings.
6 is open.
Oh, okay. That's very interesting to me. You talked about the idea that Paul Williams and she could swap at any time, but you didn't put her above Paul Williams to be able to swap at any time.
It's true. I think that's partially because I didn't realize 6 was open. We'll see.
Well, now that I've pointed it out to you, do you want to revise that?
No.
Keep her at 8.
There's still time. Maybe Mum and Shantz will be, That's what I've got for statistics this week.
As always, we end each episode going out on the high note of concentrating on our 5 favorite moments. A moment is not a full sketch, but is instead a piece of performance, a line reading or delivery, tiny piece of writing, or a piece of production that we wanted to highlight and zoom in on and give it special notice. Pete, why don't you start with your first of our 5 moments?
Well, I alluded to it earlier in this episode, but the first thing that I bolded is Statler's scrunchy face when he runs into the pillar.
Yes, you did mention that this was going to come back.
And here it is. Despite the fact that it doesn't make sense that he then just stays put and sits back down, essentially. Him turning, running, like not even running. He basically turns and headbutts the pillar and then has scrunchy face. I love a scrunchy face.
So why does this work better for you than Waldorf's scrunchy face of him popping his eyes during the... Pete's giving me a look like, maybe that's going to be my next moment, Ben. If all three of your moments are just different faces that Statler and Waldorf make, I get to take a quarter of a point back.
Well, you don't get that quarter of a point then, because that's two of my three, baby.
I'm going to violate the spirit of the five favorite moments for a little bit here by choosing a moment during the final curtain, just after Kermit has specified that these are real roses for a real lady. He then thanks Ethel Merman for being on the show, and then he says to the camera,
"Thank you for joining us, and you too out there."
This is the third weird moment where Kermit, after episodes of this not being a problem, destroys the reality of, is this a filmed show, or is this a filmed stage show, or is this a stage show? Specifically, it first comes up during the first backstage bit where Fozzie comes on to talk about his agent. Scooter interrupts him and says, "Yeah, that act's all ready to go, Chief." And Kermit says,
"Everything's ready, boss."
"Good boy, Scooter."
And then turns to the camera and says,
"That kid's doing a great job."
And then similarly, at the end of that, he also does another take to camera and says, "And his uncle owns the theater." Lines of delivery that only work if he's talking to the watching audience at home. We've got all this audience stuff going on in the show. All the stuff with the weird audience shot at the end of the Ethel Merman bit. We've got Fozzie and the disappearing audience. And yet, there are three distinct Kermit moments that are definitely aware of the fact that there is a television audience in addition to the theatrical audience. It's the clearest example of the fact that this is a live-streamed show as well as a physical show. And I hate it. Because they'd been not doing it for such a long time. And then the writing, for whatever reason, leaned into it more. So I bring it up as a moment that helps clarify that Kermit definitely knows
that it's both a television show and a stage show.
And because that has been a running thing that we've been talking about, it would be remiss of me to ignore it. But is it a favorite moment? No.
I like it. So... It's not one of my favorite moments. However, we can still count it as a favorite moment because I like it.
Talk to me about another scrunchy face you enjoyed, Peter.
Well, this isn't a scrunchy face. It's more of a bulging face. Because, yes, as you alluded to earlier in the Don't Sugar Me UK spot, there's a line that the mouse says about rolling your eyes.
Just roll them eyes.
And one of Waldorf's eyes bulges in a way I've never seen a Muppet face bulge before. And it's just the eye. Like, it must have been a different puppet or a different design. I have no idea what it was. But it was something that I've never seen before and was wild, and I really enjoyed it.
Pete, you should go back and rewatch Waldorf when Statler is backstage with the Japanese peace lily.
Okay.
Because when he's up there by himself, right before he does the maybe I'll tickle myself bit, he does a face where he's like, Statler can't do this. And he makes that same grotesque, bulgy eye thing happen. So it's very clearly something that the puppeteer is doing by poking his top fingers out through the face of the puppet while pulling the mouth in with his bottom fingers.
Yeah, liked it. It made the UK spot for me.
It's very Toxic Avenger.
Absolutely. Good pull. Good push, actually.
For my next moment, I am going to bring up how great the design of the tube Muppets in Java are. I think that the little tube is so cute and so adorable. And it's amazing how much that is just because of the ratio of the eyes to the size of the tube compared to the design and shape and size and angle of the eyes on the bigger tube. It's amazing that just the elements being slightly bigger or smaller makes one cute and one old. Like, it's fascinating that that little tiny application of essentially the same elements, however, can create real sense of personality and everything.
Well, it's also, I think, partially because the little one acts like a little kid, mimicking, like wanting so badly to be able to do what the bigger one can do, but failing so absolutely.
And his hyper energetic, I'm just dancing here, but not to the rhythm that gets him stomped on and kicked out with the fee sound effect is beautiful. But the moment that I'm going to choose as my moment, so that this isn't me saying how much I love that sketch, is the way in which, after he's blasted the bigger, older Muppet out, he jumps up and clicks his heels together with a little bing. It is perfect. It's an explosion, and then it's a button that works with the music and fits with his personality and design. That kick sums up all of that. It is the best button I can think of in the Muppet Show.
You're going to cut this out.
Okay.
But Ben, did you know that if that sketch was performed in a tent, then it would just be two tubes moving up and down?
I don't get it.
I'm equating the fact that you were just saying that this sketch essentially hinges on the music of this versus the shadow puppetry one, where you're like, if it wasn't for the music, this sketch doesn't work.
All right, I take your point, and I take your acknowledgement that I'm going to cut this out. But I think that helps reinforce the fact that I didn't have to try and figure out why wouldn't this sketch work, because it operated within the sphere of the Muppet Show.
Mm.
Whereas the shadow puppets, because Mr. Richard Bradshaw was not part of the aesthetic of it, I was looking for reasons why an audience might detach. And I didn't do that here.
Yeah.
So I didn't have the relationship with, as you point out, the fact that all of this is as equally artificial as all film production. But I didn't have to think about it because it was part of the in-universe idiom of Muppets. And therefore, it didn't feel different enough that I would question any of those things.
For my final moment, I'm going to bring up the shadow puppets.
Hmm.
Specifically, the mouse. And you alluded to this earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The little waggy tail. And how, when it went down the slide, it starts sliding, and then about halfway down, it does somersaults and tumbles.
Yeah.
And it seems like it was just a single stick. How he was able to get it to do both things is a magic trick for me. Even though you could see the stick, as I mentioned, and as you said, I usually like seeing the sticks, that actually enhanced the magic for me, because I could see one stick, and then for it to do something that I didn't expect, I was like, how? I don't know. And I like it.
It is remarkable. I understand why Henson was impressed enough with him that he wanted to give him a shot on his show. What I didn't check on the wiki is whether or not there are other guest puppeteers.
Mm.
Because it makes it sound like this is planned to be the first of a, not frequently, but occasionally recurring segment. And I have no memory of this ever coming back in any way.
As I think we've discussed before on the podcast, I
have no memory.
A, have no memory. And B, have only seen episodes here and there.
Mm.
So this is the first time I've ever done a complete watch through. So most of these episodes I have no experience with at all.
Well, we will find out then. Instead of looking at the Wikia and therefore giving us a spoiler for future seasons, we will learn that in real time if and when it happens.
This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is from archival Henson Associates clips of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformed in fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @FarstNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomenon.
There are things, dates, facts, names, Irving Berlin tunes, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest in contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete. My co-host is Ben.
Yes, I can!
And we'll see you next time when we discuss production episode 2, guest starring Connie Stevens.
Yay!